Bits was working on a novel, Zora Neale Hurston took paper and pencil and headed for home. She rented a room in Sanford, Florida, next door to the all-black town where she had grown up, and began to write Jonas Gordvine. In October 1933, a scant 4 months later, the manuscript was accepted for publication. Jonas Gordvine takes the classic form of the Bildungsroman. John, an unlettered but determined young man, ventures forth to make his fortune. What he learns of the world and his own nature form the trajectory of his life and the novel. Like those of many Black Americans, John's origins are murky. His mother, Amy, bears him while working on Alf Pearson's farm. She marries Ned Crittenden and moves to the other side of Big Creek. Ned, who was raised a slave, despises John for what he represents, for there is every indication that John is the illegitimate son of the white judge. Even as a young man, John is aware of the power of utterance. His fear of the first locomotive he sees is quickly replaced by the desire to understand it. And though he never learns to speak to his own soul, he is fascinated by the infinite variety of nature's music. John sat on the footlog and made some words to go with the drums of the creek. Things walked in the birch woods, creep, creep, creep. The hound dog's lyric crescendo lifted over and above the treetops. He was on the footlog, halfway across the big creek, where maybe people laughed and maybe people had lots of daughters. The moon came up. The hunted coon panted down to the creek. The tenor-singing hound dog went home. Night passed. No more Ned. No hurry. No telling how many girls might be living on the new and shiny side of the big creek. John almost trumpeted exultantly at the new sun. He breathed lustily. He stripped and carried his clothes across, then recrossed and plunged into the swift water and breasted strongly over. This passage contains all the elements of John's spirit, his exuberant masculine energy, his gift for language, and his intense relationship between his interior self and the natural world, both his headstrong lustiness and his ability for provident forethought. He carries his clothes across the river, then recrosses before swimming over. This scene, however, occurs right after his mother's repeated warning not to swim the Songahatchee, and John's parting promise to her to stop running and a-ripping and climbing trees and rocks and jumping. The seeds of his inner conflict are evident. In an ironic twist recalling the incestuous relationships in the South, John leaves home to find work under Alf Pearson, who remarks, "Your face looks sort of familiar, but I can't place you," before giving him the cast-off clothes of his legitimate son. But when the judge's wife objects to John driving their coach, he is put to work in the barns. John, who adopts Pearson as his surname, is an immediate success among the Black workers, especially the women. They seduce him right and left. He focuses his attention on the fiery little Lucy Potts, the smartest Black girl in the area. Her excellence inspires John to eat up debt school, and he joins the church when he is told that Lucy sings in the choir. After a determined courtship, Lucy and John become man and wife. Although John left home at the suggestion of his mother, he soon learns the temptation of flight. Whenever things get sticky, he runs away. And just as he is able to break a promise to his mother minutes afterward without a second thought, John sees no discrepancy in enjoying a stream of women while swearing to love Lucy body and soul. Even before marriage, John must leave the Pearson place and find work at a logging camp to escape a jealous husband. And though he swears to Lucy that I loves you and you alone, after marriage, he still cannot stay away from other women. There is Mahaley and Big Omen and then Delphine, who comforts John while Lucy lies in labor with their fourth child. When Lucy's brother takes their marriage bed in partial payment of a debt, John beats him up and is consequently summoned to court.